Steiner, and welcome this hour. Today we'll look at the allegations that the Maryland ACLU has made against the Maryland State Police. Recently released documents show the police spent 2 years spying on anti-death penalty and peace groups. We'll speak with an ACLU attorney and members of the peace groups that were spied upon. Then we'll look at the impact of mountaintop removal on one West Virginia community, about how this coal mining practice destroyed this community, threatened their lives, and our environment. And we'll bring you a conversation with textile artist Sonia Clark, whose pieces made of human hair talk to our vision of race and sexuality in America. So join me for an hour of conversation about our civil liberties, coal mining, and art and identity, right after this NPR news break. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome here this hour, the Mark Steiner Show here on WEAA. You can join us here at 410-319-8888. That's 410-319-8888. Anybody who's old as I am remembers COINTELPRO, and when the FBI and federal government destroyed lives, killed people around the country, when they spied on anti-war groups. Dozens of anti-war activists were thrown in jail, many physically injured, some murdered. And here we have not that taking place, but it raises its head in a different form when we have just found out that the Maryland State Police for 16 months infiltrated peace groups and anti-death penalty groups. And in that, we were all kind of very shocked to hear and see that. That took place under Governor Ehrlich's administration when Superintendent Tim Hutchins was the head of the state police. We asked the state police to join us today. They declined. We tried to get in touch with Governor Ehrlich. We could not get in touch with him, but we attempted to. We have invited on here today people to talk about what is going on and what this all really means. We have with us in studio David Rocha, who's an attorney for the American Civil Liberties Union of Maryland, who launched this lawsuit and investigation. David, good to have you with us once again.
So great to be back with you.
Well, I mean, once again, on the new Mark Steiner Show here on WEAA. We're also joined by Maria Allwein, who is a member of the Baltimore Pledge of Resistance Group and a former Green Party candidate for president of the Baltimore City Council. And the Pledge of Resistance is one of the groups that was infiltrated by the state police. Maria, good to have you with us.
Wonderful to be with you again, Mark.
And Max Obachevsky is with us, who is a member of Pledge of Resistance Baltimore and has been a peace activist for 40 years or more, a long time. He's been fighting for peace as a deep believer in nonviolence and would not harm another human being, was a key part of this investigation for some reason we'll talk about. Max, welcome. Good to see you, too.
It's always good to be on the air with you, Mark.
410-319-8888. Join us. What do you think about this investigation that's taking place and what place it has in our society, if any, and what we should be doing to ensure that this is controlled? David, tell us how this started and how the ACLU got involved in this and what let me read the statement, by the way, real quick from the Maryland State Police and go right to David. The state police issued this statement saying, while these events happened in 2005 and 2006 under the previous administration, the Maryland State Police under O'Malley Brown administration does not and will not use public resources to target or monitor peaceful activists where Maryland citizens are exercising their First Amendment rights. The state police and other law enforcement agencies have an obligation to take seriously and investigate all potential threats to public safety consistent with state and federal law, including the criminal intelligence system's operating policies contained in 28 Code of Federal Regulations, Part 23. But where there is no evidence of potential public threat, illegal activity, or criminal wrongdoing, all investigatory and intelligence activities will cease. David?
That statement is good as far as it goes, but of course we still need to know what happened and why it happened. The origins of this go back to a protest that the Baltimore Pledge of Resistance did in 2004 at the NSA headquarters. Protesting there has been a regular annual activity, almost annual activity for them. And at one of these protests, two people were arrested for engaging in an act of peaceful civil disobedience, which consisted of sitting down on the ground and refusing to leave when told to leave. hardly a violent act. In the course of the criminal trial from that trespass arrest, documents were turned over by the prosecution, which gave some indication that surveillance had taken place of the protesters as they gathered at the American Friends Service Committee here in Baltimore to head down to the NSA and literally follow them almost minute by minute. So when they turned those documents over to us and said, we're concerned that we're being watched and, you know, why is this happening?
And when was this? When did that take place?
The protest and the surveillance was in 2004.
I just wanted to correct a little bit just so the historical record's accurate. It was actually October 4th of 03, and there were five of us arrested. We all did the same thing, three of us, myself included. Some of your listeners would know Jay Gillen as well, who's been working with Project Algebra. For whatever reason, they and remember, these are military prosecutors. They dropped the charges against three of us, went forward with this case for with Marilyn Carlisle and Cindy Farquhar, and the case was October 23rd and 24th of 04.
Well, in the time we have, before we go to the phones here at 410-319-8888, I want to recall something here, Marie Alwine. I want to bring you into this conversation and your thoughts on this. I remember it was several years ago you were on my program, and we had a debate about the war and government surveillance, and there were two former assistant attorney generals on, one from the Reagan administration and one from Clinton's administration. You said on that program, people are watching us. We are being followed by the government. Things are happening inside of our groups. And everybody, both liberal and conservative, went, we don't think that's really happening. And, of course, the conservative said it was absurd. It could never happen. But several years ago, you were saying this was going on and nobody was paying attention.
Well, several years ago, we got these internal NSA email documents during discovery during this trial that Max and David are talking about. And so we were well aware that we were being surveilled. And you're right, we couldn't get anyone to pay attention to it. I remember that show really well. And it's very difficult to get people to believe that this is going on. And it is going on. And when you look at the historical record, when you look at COINTELPRO, well, of course it's still going on. What in the world would make anyone think that just because there's a change in administration, maybe it's the Republicans or the Democrats or whatever, that this isn't policy at various times?
And I wonder if you have an idea about this. And David, you're calling in, many of you are calling for legislation for Martin O'Malley to put in, the governor to put in, to have oversight over the Homeland Security and Intelligence Division of the Maryland State Police, some kind of oversight. And Governor O'Malley has always been one to say that the federal government is not doing enough to put enough funds into and help states really watch the dangers we may face from terrorist threats, the port, rail, airports, you know, the things that are very real in many ways. So the question I have is, and what I want to ask the governor and others, is where that outrage is for misspending our money and taking trained investigators to watch peace groups and anti-death penalty groups as opposed to actually protecting our ports, our rails, and our airports. So talk a bit about what kind of conversation you've had with the government, our state government, about this.
Well, I mean, I think there's at least two important things to say about this. One is that this was not a trivial allocation of resources. This was at least two undercover agents over a 14-month period, at least 288 hours of their time by their own reckoning.
How much money do you know? How much money was spent?
We don't know how much money. But the other important thing that people should be aware of is that what we've uncovered here is, I won't say by accident, but almost by accident. That is, the Public Information Act request that led to these disclosures relates to only a few peace groups and a few activists. The reason that we've uncovered so much more is by the happenstance of overlap among membership of the peace groups and the anti-death penalty groups, which leads me to believe that as flabbergasted as I was to learn about this surveillance, I will be even more flabbergasted if this turns out to be the full extent of it. And then,
why do you say that?
Well, because, as I say, we got this almost by accident. That is, we weren't looking for surveillance of anti-death penalty groups. We had no reason to believe it was going on. And frankly, if the anti-death penalty groups had come to me 2 weeks ago and said, we're being surveilled and people are coming to our meetings undercover, mm-hmm. I would have said to them, like perhaps the guests on your earlier radio show, I think you guys may be a little bit paranoid. You know, show me some evidence and, you know, then I'll take it seriously. And that goes to – because, why on earth would the police spend this time? At some level, it's just – it's so crazy and almost laughable that it could just be comical. But it's serious for two reasons. One, the waste of resources. Police resources are a zero-sum game. If they're spending their time doing this, it means they're not spending their time doing the important work
right.
that we all agree needs to be done. But equally importantly, this does have a terribly chilling effect in at least two important ways. One, it makes people fearful of engaging in their constitutional right to organize with their fellow citizens on matters that concern them because they now, I think, quite legitimately fear that doing so means that their names end up in a government criminal database. And two, when groups that are organizing think that the next person showing up at their meeting is not someone who really wants to work with them, but an undercover agent, think what that does to their organizing.
David Rocha is attorney for the American Civil Liberties Union. Maria Allwine and Max Obuchevsky are part of Pledge of Resistance, two of the groups that were spied upon by the Maryland State Police. The number here is 410-319-8888. Let's go to the phones. And I think I have the hang of this now. And Mike in Ellicott City. You're not in the air yet. Wait. Are you on the air?
I don't know.
There you are. You're on the air. Go ahead.
I'm glad to hear it. Good morning, gentlemen and ladies. First of all, I absolutely support every damn thing you're doing. But I want to criticism to make. The guy who said he was flabbergasted, as I understand the word, frankly, it means surprised. You ain't been paying attention. That's what they do. Does anyone, a quiz, I used to be a math teacher, this is a minor math problem. Does anyone know in dozens how many countries, foreign countries, have bases occupied by U.S. military personnel? Take a guess.
It's at least 165 or so.
That's not dozens. There aren't that many countries in the world. So divide that by 12, and that'll work. I wanted to keep the numbers down, but you got the gist of it. The federal government is based, its policy is based on terrorism. Of course the state apparatus supports it by attempting to control and keep their eye on those who would stop it. That's what they do. You may know how to spell democracy, but don't think that's where you live. It's not realistic.
Mike, thank you so much. Max, you can respond to the call.
I do want to respond. I suspect that was Mike from Charles Village.
I don't know.
That now lives in Ellicott City. But anyway, I would urge Mike and all others that are interested in this issue to pick up a copy of the June 3rd, 2002 Nation, because Bob Dreyfus came to Maryland, investigative reporter, came to Maryland and interviewed the state police captain chief of state police at that time, Ed Norris, and other members of the police agencies in Maryland. Remember, this is just after 9/11, and Colonel David Mitchell is quoted in the article as saying, we are watching peace groups. We are going onto the internet to see what they're doing, et cetera. But then he segues into, if we suspect that there will be any violence involved in this, we will then infiltrate their groups. And he concludes that particular paragraph with that there was going to be an IMF World Bank protest in Washington, D.C. at the time. So we understand that. If there's any possible threat of violence, that the state police would get involved. But we have a record of engaging in nonviolence.
What I want to do, though, is let's talk about where the future goes. Where does this go, Maria Allwine and Dave Rocha, Max Obuchevsky? What aid do your groups pursue now? And B, what could the state possibly do to change this behavior?
Well, as far as, are you talking about where we're going with the with the lawsuit with the ACLU. I'd let David talk about that.
There's four critical questions that need to be answered. How did this happen? Why did it happen? Why was it allowed to go on so long? What's the full scope? And what's going to be done to make sure it never happens again? The other important thing that, in addition to answering those questions, that has to happen is the all the people whose names were taken down, so to speak, need to be notified and need to be given an opportunity to review the information and get them out of these government criminal databases. That's what we're looking for from the state. If the state isn't willing to do that voluntarily, then we will pursue every legal tool at our disposal to make sure that those things happen.
Is there reason to believe that, like in your case, Max Obuchevsky, where you've been named to a kind of a notorious list of drug traffickers and others, because of these investigations, that your name has not, should, and will not be removed from these lists?
As you well know, the ACLU the same week revealed that there's a watch list of a million people. It's actually not...
Not the state of Maryland, you mean in the United States.
United States. Somebody compiled this list. I mean, we know in Denver, and there was a settlement in Denver in 1999. The American Friends Service Committee was listed as a terrorist group in the database. Their ACLU actually got in agreement with the city and the police that they're not going to be
infiltrated. And we're talking about a nonviolent Quaker organization. Right.
Society of Friends.
Right.
Getting back, though, I think this is important. Getting back to the surprise factor, we actually knew that surveillance was going on. We did not have the proof. I was at the meeting last night of our death penalty group because I'm cross fertilized in all of these documents because I'm with all of these groups.
No wonder they're going after you, Max.
And we're having a forum at St. John's 27 in St. Paul at 7 p.m. to talk about this on Thursday evening, and we're going to use this because right now in the state of Maryland there's this commission that's studying the death penalty. And so we're going to use this to try to organize people, get people behind us. We want to get rid of this death penalty. So that's something in the future. We're going to continue protesting. We're going to continue speaking out against the war. We're bringing into Baltimore again Japanese survivors August 6th, for example. So we're going to continue our work. It's very, very chilling, though, for people who do not have necessarily what we have, that we're going to continue doing this regardless of the consequences. There's people out there who are not going to come to meetings, not going to sign petitions, going to avoid us, get off of my e-list, for example. And that's really, really terrifying. And that's why we got to work closely with the ACLU to get information that the Baltimore City Intelligence Division has and others.
I'm going to cut you off, Max.
Oh, no, please do.
Maria, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say that's Max is exactly right. That's where our real work lies. We're committed. We're not intimidated. And we've known about this. It's upsetting. I personally want the opportunity to see what databases my name might be in. But the point is that this does affect other people's willingness to come forward and actually take action rather than just sit back and disagree. And it's critical that people do take action, especially at this time in our history. And that is the real effect of this kind of behavior by police agencies.
We had an email at thesteinershow@gmail.com. Somebody's called in, wrote in and said, will state police also surveil right-to-lifers who have used violence in the past, or do they only spy on those who oppose the Bush administration? 410-319-8888.
Good question.
Greg in Baltimore. You're not on the air yet. Why is this not working? There we go. Greg, you're on the air.
Hello?
You're on the air, Greg.
Okay. I just want to thank, first of all, the work they're doing. All these three people, but I do have a question. If since a lot of people who are involved or pay attention to public policy already know that the police are spying on peace groups, and it was even in the Michael Moore movie Fahrenheit 9/11 like 3 years ago, so what does it mean when you said that people from the state were on your radio show a couple of years ago saying that it's unbelievable, it's preposterous, when a lot of people already expect this?
The people on my show, is Michael Greenberg, who was a former assistant attorney general under the Clinton administration, and is Virginia Tonsing. Victoria Tonsing, yeah. Who was an assistant attorney general under Reagan. And it was she, actually, who said this could never be taking place. It's absurd to think that it would happen, and challenged Maria and kind of try to put her down in the air as being unrealistic. That's what that happened. Greg, it's good to hear from you. So I want to know where we go from here. What happens next, and what are the political ramifications of this? What is, Brian Frosch, who is a state senator from Montgomery County, has called for investigations.
And hearings
in Annapolis. Senator Ben Cardin has called for a full accounting of what has happened, using the same word you did, David Rocha, accounting. So let's talk about what that means.
Right. Well, as I said, we need to know the full scope of this. It would be very surprising if this turned out to be the full scope. And the most important thing that I think will come out of this will be binding legal controls. You referred at the beginning of the hour to the COINTELPRO program, which was a huge scandal, and people will perhaps remember the Church Committee hearings and the famous Church Committee report, which documented many decades of unlawful activities by the federal government aimed at domestic political protesters, including folks in the civil rights and anti-war movement, among others. And after the Church Committee report was issued, Congress was poised to pass some very important reform legislation, which would have put binding controls on the FBI. And
so by the time you have left, what do you expect to happen in Maryland, since we're not going to have those same kind of controls? It's a different situation.
Well, I do expect controls to be put in, because I think the lesson that wasn't learned in the 1970s, what happened after the Church Committee report, was that the FBI said, we've learned our lessons, we'll never do it again, we agree it was wrong, we've adopted stringent internal controls to prevent this from ever happening again. And indeed, the internal controls that they then adopted were very stringent. And after 9/11, Attorney General John Ashcroft threw them all in the garbage can and said, all bets are off. The point is that internal controls are only as good as the folks who wrote them are willing to abide by them. Laws have much more power. And I think what this instance shows is that internal controls are not enough, and there need to be actual laws in place to prevent this from happening. And that's what we will be pushing for in the upcoming legislative session. And I think the hearings will be critical to ensure that the public is fully informed of the full scope of what happened.
What legislators are sponsoring the legislation? Who's going to do that for you?
It's too early to tell at this point.
So, Max, go ahead. Max, I
was just going to mention our friend, Senator Jim Brochin.
Baltimore County.
Right. Some people might remember that 8 members of the Pledge of Resistance were arrested while handing out anti-war leaflets at the Towson Town Center March 1st of 2003. We were kept in custody. I was handcuffed to a wall for 16 hours. They weren't taking us to the police commissioner. The reason being, Terry Sheridan was the Baltimore County chief of police at that time.
Who's now the head of the state police.
Exactly. They weren't taking us to the commissioner. There was only one other prisoner brought in during all of this time. They weren't taking us over because some members of the Baltimore County Police were already in Kuwait preparing for the invasion of Iraq. Who stepped forward after reading the Sun articles? Laura Barnhart wrote lots of articles about this. Jim Brochin stepped forward. He was not going to stand for a violation of our First Amendment rights, mistreatment, etc. He's now stepping forward again. He's the one that sent a letter to Brian Frosch. We got to have a hearing, and that's the first step. Let's have the hearing. Let's air this out. Let's everybody testify. Let's find all this information. And I agree completely with David and the ACLU. And we have to thank them tremendously for doing this heroic work. Is we've got to get something concrete, legislation. That's the only way this is going to stop. We could go back to the Red Square. We could go back to I didn't even know this till I read Dennis Sweeney's op-ed in the Sun, how far back they were searching for communists in the state of Maryland and in Attorney General's office.
There were active Red Squads in the city of Baltimore, the city police department under Parmalee, then commissioner in the 60s and early 70s, and they were all over the place infiltrating groups right and left and actually instigating violence inside those groups, as I remember it well. 30 years ago here in the city of Baltimore. So this is not a minor issue when it comes to our civil liberties. Let's see, somebody has a quick comment. I'm going to go back to the phones to get a quick thought from a listener, 410-319-8888. Fran, in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Hi, Mark.
Hi, Fran.
Hi. And hi, Max and everybody.
We only have a couple minutes left here in the segment.
Okay. Something I wanted to say was you just mentioned the surveillance from the 70s. I worked for AFSC for 30 years and did GI work. So I think one area that needs to be looked at is what is going on with Iraqi veterans against war and Vietnam Veterans Against War and some of those other groups, I suspect the surveillance is very prevalent in those corners also. But I really admire what Max and the ACLU and the others are doing. So thank you.
Thank you so much, friend. Good to hear from you. So when you say it hasn't deterred you, do you have any evidence this has really deterred other people from joining your groups?
Yes, absolutely. I have an e-list. 500 people get 4 emails a day of progressive news announcements, et cetera. And there are people, even before this blew, everybody knew I'm on all kinds of databases. I mean, you know, everybody knows me. I know lots of police agencies, et cetera. And even before that, people were frightened to be on my e-list because then they suspected that somebody is listening.
You're a pretty frightening character there, Max. I'll be sure to tell you.
Yes, I am. As I think someone said this to me. Oh, Terry Fitzgerald, who's also with the Physicians for Social Responsibility, he was being interviewed, and that question was asked: is Max a terrorist? Well, he says if there's injustice in this world, and he notices and he's speaking out against it. Yes, in that respect, he is a dangerous person.
Well, I really do want to thank all of you for being here. This has been fascinating. We'll follow this as the show progresses and this case progresses, and of course, the state legislative session comes up in a new daily show here during the fall. I want to thank David Rocha from the ACLU and Maria Allwine and Max Obuszewski from Pledge of Resistance for joining us. It's good to see you all and keep up your work. It's important for all of us to have you with us.
It was a pleasure, Mark.
This is the time for people to join us.
Folks, stay with us. We'll be right back, and we'll be talking with a very interesting artist, Sonia Clark, and hear a report from David Jarrell in West Virginia about what Mountaintop Removal is doing. So don't go away. The Mark Steiner Show will continue in just a minute. Welcome back to the Mark Steiner Show. Now we're going to bring you a story that our producer, Justin Levy, traveled to the cold fields of West Virginia to record. Last fall on the Mark Steiner Show, we discussed a form of coal mining called mountaintop removal. We had a group of guests that included a coal industry representative, a retired mine inspector, and residents of the coal fields. What they described sounded more like a nightmare than reality. A growing mining practice where the tops of mountains are blown off with dynamite in order to expose coal seams beneath the surface. The coal is then dug from the new surface of the mountain, and when it's gone, there's a flat expanse of barren land. Entire ecosystems are being destroyed, and the communities around them are being poisoned by the pollution that's left behind. We wondered how this could be going on without there being more of an outcry. After all, the coal that's produced here is the same coal that burns in many of the power plants that provide us here in Maryland with power. BG&E uses coal from mountaintop removal mines. You can go to ilovemountains.org/myconnection. Type in your zip code to find out more about the connection between the energy you use in your home and mountaintop removal. And with the concerns about the price and scarcity of oil, many people are pointing to coal as a reliable form of energy for years to come. So we decided it was important to see mountaintop removal for ourselves and to speak with people who live with what is happening in their own backyards. Here's the first of a series of stories we'll be bringing you about life in the modern-day coal fields. It's told by Debbie Jarrell in her own words. Debbie is a lifelong resident of Rock Creek, a tiny town off of Route 3 in Raleigh County, West Virginia. It sits on Coal River, which runs through Coal River Valley, at the foot of Coal River Mountain. Coal has been the lifeblood of that town for generations, but Debbie's roots go back centuries further. This is her story, in her words.
My name is Debbie Jarrell. I'm from Rock Creek, West Virginia, born and raised here, so basically I've been here all my life. My mother's side of the family, the Webbs, they came to West Virginia in the 1600s, basically farmers. My family on my father's side, the Jarrells, they come here in this area in the 1700s. They weren't coal miners at that time. They were, I don't know if you would call them survivalists or what, but they lived off the land, and they knew how to respect that to sustain them and their families. My grandfather, he died from black lung. My dad, he retired from the coal mines with partial black lung. And it's just been within my lifetime that we've been able to absolutely destroy any type of sustainable life in a lot of these hollows. Something that I'm thankful that my grandmother isn't alive to see. My grandmother was a major factor in my life. We lived with her until, I guess I was 7 years old, but we called her Ma. She ginsenged, picked blackberries, canned everything that she could from the gardens, killed her chickens, plucked them, boiled the hog's head to make sauce, just everything, the leather breeches, hung them up on the porch, and I was able to help her do that. And I feel so fortunate that I have an understanding of what our land is able to give you if you take care of it. With this form of mining, mountaintop removal, it's killing our communities. It's removing heritage from the hollows. People are moving out. The hollows are getting closed off. The coal companies don't want you up there. And it's with great sadness that my grandchildren, if something isn't done, aren't going to be able to enjoy what I was able to enjoy. The knowledge that these mountains will protect you, the knowledge that God put everything here that we need to live life. Taken, it may not be what everyone else would think life should be. You know, the high-priced cars and everything else that people seem to think that you have to have. But the basics, your food, your water, and your family is all right here. And to see the type of destruction that the coal company and our government is putting upon West Virginia, it baffles a person. Why are they doing this? Why? After hundreds of years of being able to live here and sustain yourself, why are they totally destroying everything that a person needs? When I was a small child, I was able to roam the woods anywhere I wanted to. I was able to get in the river and go swimming. And when thirsty, if I was up in the woods, I was able to kneel down and get me a drink of water. Slowly over the years, you have to quit fishing in the water. You have to quit letting your children or your grandchildren swim in the rivers because of the pollutants and the stuff that they dump in it. And very few streams in our mountains can you kneel down and drink out of it with the knowledge that it's good, clean water. The communities themselves, this used to be a very, very lively valley. And slowly over the years, they've come in, shut down our schools, shut down the heads of the hollers where family had lived for generations, and slowly gated the people off from the mountains. The free roaming is no more. The feeling of you and nature as one, that's going to be lost and lost soon. I'm fortunate enough that I know what that is. I'm fortunate enough that I taught my children, and hopefully I'll be fortunate enough to be able to teach my grandchildren that feeling, the understanding of what we have. A lot of people feel that mountaintop removal is the only way that they can make a living. But what they're not understanding is it's doing away with a lot of the deep mining jobs. They're not needed the numbers aren't needed to strip mine a mountain where they're needed in underground mining. And the coal companies and the coal associations, they're making everyone think that if we don't have mountaintop removal, we're not going to have anything in this area, which is totally untrue. I truly believe in my heart that there are other ways that people can make a living on this river besides destroying our communities. I truly believe that we're destroying ourselves, and people need to educate themselves on what is happening and get beyond the coal propaganda that's spewing out there. We have the possibility of putting wind energy on Coal River Mountain. The plans are for 400 megawatts of power, which would cover basically 6,000 acres of the mountainous range that are named after this valley, Coal River Mountain. The coal company is wanting to destroy that mountain range. But the power potential on that mountain is some of the best that we have in the nation. But it's going to be up to us to drill it into our politician's head, our county commission's head, that we don't have to have mountaintop removal. We can put the windmills on these mountains, 150 jobs while they're being constructed, 50 permanent jobs for the locals in our area. For as long as those wind turbines sit there, we still have our mountains with those wind turbines sitting there. We still have our clean streams. We still have our communities. We're still able to hunt those mountains. We're still able to ginseng, go hunt ramps, molly moochers, whatever one wants to do in those mountains. But if we lose this, and they're able to mine that, there'll be no more Coal River Mountain. And that is a sad proposition in my mind when we have the opportunity to have it all.
You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show. You're just hearing the voice of Debbie Jarrell, recorded at her home in Rock Creek, West Virginia. To learn more about mountaintop removal, go to our website, www.centerforemergingmedia.org.
In the city, there's work for the minions. In the city, there's wine and there's food. Down in the holler, there's no decent work. It's a tunnel, the mountains through. So I took a job on a blasting rig with the sand and gravel and stone.
Do you run your hands happily through your lover's hair, but cringe when you find one of those hairs on your pillow or in a dish they've prepared for you? Do you spend hundreds of dollars on fancy salons and designer gels and shampoo just to achieve that just-rolled-out-of-bed look? Do you agonize over hair that's thinning as you get older? Is your hair more important to you than you might like to admit? These are just a few of the tensions that textile artist Sonia Clark's work evokes. Her new exhibit at the Walters Art Museum, Loose Strands, Tight Knots, is full of pieces she made using her own hair, and in some cases, the hair of other people. As a black woman, she's well aware of the complicated and fascinating role that hair plays in the African-American community amid the dominant culture's notions of beauty. Her work's a comment on these things and on the tradition of craft, a tradition she carries on from her grandparents, who are carpenters and tailors. Her work investigates our ideas about identity, beauty, history, racial politics, and much more. Sonia Clark sat down with me to discuss her work. You can see it now at the Walters Art Museum, where it will be installed until September 21st. Enjoy the conversation. I'm sitting here in the studio with Sonia Clark, who has a new exhibit at the Walters Art Museum called Loose Strands and Tight Knots. Sonia Clark is chair of the Department of Craft and Material Studies at Virginia Commonwealth, the University of School for the Arts in Richmond, and she joins us here today to talk about her work. It's good to meet you. Good to have you here.
And my pleasure to be here, Mark. Nice to join you.
I was fascinated by the idea of working with hair, mm-hmm. with human hair, with your hair.
Mm-hmm.
But I get the sense that people have been working with hair for a long time.
For a long time. I was trained as a textile artist or a fiber artist, and I often think, what was the first fiber art? And, of course, that's hairstyling. And it's something that we're all familiar with.
You know, that's hair is fiber, right?
Hair is fiber.
I never thought of it
as
fiber art.
Right. And as soon as we are manipulating it, then we're manipulating that fiber. And as soon as we're manipulating it for aesthetic purposes, then it's art.
But you seem to have a kind of, I'd like to talk a bit about your philosophical view of hair.
Mm.
I mean, what it means beyond just taking strands of your hair that might come out when you're combing it and collecting it and using it.
Yeah. And actually, I've done a recent collection. For those of you who can't see me, my afro used to be twice as big as it is, and now it's a little shorn because I had to make an art piece. But
you shore your hair for your art.
Yes, that's right. That's right. I cut it off because I had a piece that I had to make, and I said, it'll grow back. But the thing about hair is that I think it's almost impossible to, in this country, talk about issues of hair without getting into issues of race. And so I think that there's a little bit of that kind of dialogue that's in the work, because though I have multiple heritages, I do identify as an African-American person.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing about hair is that it can be sort of this divide, you know, this idea of what constitutes cultural notions of beauty. And I made a piece once. It's an image of Abraham Lincoln that I've sewn an afro on. It's not in the show, by the way. So it's a $5 bill, and it's called Afro Abe, and he has this big afro. And people think that's really amusing. And it is intended, honestly. It's intended to be amusing. But there is this other part of it that I realized, why is that so funny? Because it's not mm-hmm. so strange for a black woman to walk down the street with her hair straightened. People don't find that funny. Right? And the reason that they don't find it funny is that it has something to do with sort of cultural notions of what is deemed to be normative beauty. And in this culture, normative beauty often ends up being dominant culture beauty, right? So putting an afro on Abe is a little weird because that's not dominant culture beauty, at least not in hair, right?
Right.
Whereas putting straight hair on a black woman, not funny, that's normal.
Seen as normal.
Yeah. And so those kinds of things become a kind of interesting thing. So there's a sort of aspect that has to do with what happens culturally in the Americas and with those of us who came over through forced migration that makes hair and hair politics and hygiene and beauty complicated.
And how do you think your work speaks to that?
Well, I think that there's something about it's pretty clear that it's not European hair that's being used. And so already someone can guess something about the maker. I also think that there's something, if I can sort of attend to my own use of my own hair, is that I grew up with a Jamaican mother, Trinidadian father, but a Jamaican mother who was like, if we cut your hair, we burn it, we bury it, we don't just let it go.
Someone else could take that hair and use it and do something to you.
That's absolutely right.
Right,
and
right.
So, you know, to go to that place of discomfort as an artist and say, I'm using my own hair to make artworks that are, and here's the kicker. Beauty in this nation. Then I'm making artwork out of my own hair and selling it. Huh, are you allowed to sell things? I'm selling my own body into the art market, is that right? And you know, my mother certainly would not approve of that, but there are several things I do that she does not approve of. But but just thinking about beauty as a commodity, right? Or something that's antithetical to normative beauty as a commodity. So I think that those kinds of things, I think there's something about disembodied hair There's a difference between running your hands through the hair of a lover and a hair in a sink that you don't know who it belongs to. You know, as soon as it's disembodied, there's a kind of ick factor, frankly.
Right.
And it makes for this sort of visceral, uncomfortable place. And I don't hope to agitate with the work, but I do hope to provoke. And so provoke can take you to provocative, hopefully. And I'm hoping that the work does a little bit of that.
Where did you begin with hair? I mean, how did this medium become your medium?
Again, it really came from the idea of thinking about, you know, a lot of craft artists get very defensive saying, you know, doing this art and craft debate, which I'm actually not particularly interested in. And I realize that a fair amount of that has to do with my homage to my grandmother, who was a tailor, and my grandfather. These are both on my mother's side. My grandmother was a tailor. My grandfather was a furniture maker. And so I belonged already. I've let you know that I belong to this tradition of craft makers, and I feel very strongly about that. And yet the question of where, you know, what is the first textile form is what led me to the idea of hairdressing. Now, how did I get interested in textiles to begin with?
Right.
I could blame that on my grandmother, who taught me how to sew and taught me how to thread a needle in a magical way. I mean, that I can't explain on the air, but really in a way that looks like a magic trick, and it works every time. I got interested in textiles because, again, of this idea of ubiquity. So, and listeners, you'll just have to trust me on this, but Mark and I are here in this room, and we are both wearing clothes. So.
Yes, we are.
trust me, we're both wearing clothes. What I mean to imply by that is that there is one thing that we're always, always in contact with, and that's clothing. And so there is an understanding of textiles. And so, again, it becomes about a shared language that people can understand. So grandmother, sort of an homage to her hands being re-embodied in my own, but also trying to use a language that is ubiquitous so that people are drawn into the artwork, not shut out from it. I want a 3-year-old to understand my work, and I want someone with 7 PhDs to have something to hold and see and be challenged by as well. If I can do that, that's a successful piece.
You use your own hair.
I do.
You don't use other people's hair.
I do sometimes
use
other people's hair. Yeah. The first piece I made out of hair was by a friend of mine who is happens to be biracial, so she grows hair very, very, very quickly. And so she would wear her hair in dreadlocks, and then it would grow, and she'd decide she didn't want them, and she'd cut them off. And she didn't grow up with these notions of you, when you get rid of your hair, you should dispose
right.
of it properly. So she just gave it to me, and I said, oh, this is terrific. And a piece that I made was is in the show, made out of her hair, and it's called Hair Wreath. And it's borrowing from this Victorian tradition of Victorian hair wreaths. And what people used to do was take straight European hair and make it into these beautiful, beautiful flowers. Beautiful flowers. And they would make them sort of as these friendship wreaths or to memorialize someone who had passed away. And everyone would make a little flower out of their hair. This one's made with dreadlocks, so it looks more like branches.
Mm.
We were talking about, you know, how quickly hair grows
mm-hmm.
just a moment ago. And so there is one piece in the exhibition that there are a couple pieces in the exhibition that are photographs. And some of them are more clearly, more evidently photographs than others. But there is this one piece that whenever I have shown it, I have always caught someone touching the artwork. One of the things about hair is that it does sort of measure our lives in a way. And you know, the beauty of dreadlocks is that they have all of the hair that has grown and actually become disembodied, felted, you know, dreadlocked to the hair that you're currently growing. And I thought, wow, this is a dreadlock can really measure your life in this way. It has your old hair and your new hair connected. And I thought, well, it would be really wonderful to make a piece that would represent how long one's hair would be if it never stopped growing, if it was always connected. In other words, a dreadlock that potentially was started at birth and finished at the end of life. How long would that be? And I calculated, because the average, our hair, everybody's hair, on average, grows about 5 inches a year. some people's more, some people a little less, but about 5 inches a year. And so doing that, I realized that if you live to 90-some years, that would be about 30 feet and a little longer. And so I made, a digital image of a dreadlock that is about 30 feet long. And that's in the exhibition. And because it's a really good print, it honestly looks like hair. And this is the piece I always catch people getting really close to wanting to touch because it's an image. Right. I mean, you can tell it's an image because not all 30 feet is splayed out. Part of it is rolled up. But still, people, it looks so three-dimensional.
It's been wonderful, Sonia Clark. Thanks so much.
My pleasure, Mark. My pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to an excerpt of my interview with Sonia Clark, an amazing textile artist whose pieces made of human hair are currently being exhibited at the Walters Art Museum through September 21st. Don't miss a chance to hear Sonia speak about her work on Saturday, September 13th at 2 p.m. at the Walters Art Museum. You can call 410-547-9000 for more information. And you can visit our website at www.centerforemergingmedia.org to hear the full version of this interview. Thanks to all of our guests today, Sonia Clark, Debbie Jarrell, David Rocha, Maria Allwine, and Max Obachevsky. And thanks to all of you for tuning in and listening. The Mark Steiner Show is produced by Jessica Phillips and Justin Levy. We're engineered by Zachary Coleman. Thanks to our interns today, Judith Lloyd, Stavros Halkias, Christina Arison, and Amy Heck-Zeisis. Thanks to Clean Cuts for providing us with office and studio space. And to hear past episodes of The Mark Steiner Show, as well as more of our interviews, go to our website, www.centerforemergingmedia.org. And for Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.